Hello, and welcome to the Lefty Leftist Podcast. I'm Nate, your host, and today I finally talk about Cuba. Now, quick disclaimer, today's episode is based on a script I have prepared for you. I will read the script and pause whenever I have any additional comments. This always happens because when I'm presenting, new ideas pop in and, well, I just have to share them. Anyways, enjoy the episode and follow me on social media. Please, you'll find the links in the description of this episode.
Ahora sí, la historia tendrá que contar con los pobres de América, con los explotados y vilipendiados de América Latina, que han decidido empezar a escribir ellos mismos para siempre su historia. Y esa ola de estremecido rencor, de justicia reclamada, de derecho pisoteado que se empieza a levantar por entre las tierras de Latinoamérica, esa ola ya no parará más. Esa ola irá creciendo cada día que pase, porque esa ola la forman los más, los mayoritarios en todos los aspectos. Los que acumulan con su trabajo las riquezas, crean los valores, hacen andar las ruedas de la historia y que ahora despiertan del largo sueño embrutecedor a que los sometieron. Porque esta gran humanidad ha dicho basta y ha echado a andar. Y su marcha de gigantes ya no se detendrá hasta conquistar la verdadera independencia por la que ya han muerto más de una vez inútilmente. Ahora, en todo caso, los que mueran morirán como los de Cuba, los de Playa Girón. Morirán por su única, verdadera, irrenunciable independencia.
Cuba nos une extranjero suelo. Ahora hasta Cuba nuestro amor desea. Cuba es tu corazón, Cuba es mi cielo. Cuba en tu libro mi palabra sea. That was Cuba nos une by the famous Cuban poet Jose Martí. In English, it reads something like this. Cuba unites us in a foreign land. Our love longs for Cuban dawns. Cuba is your heart. Cuba is my sky. In your book, Cuba is my word. A short but powerful four-line poem to start off today's episode, perhaps my most anticipated episode to date, about Cuba, and more specifically, its revolution. As you can probably tell, this episode is longer than my usual uploads, so if you're the type who can't sit through a long lecture, I strongly encourage you to listen to this episode in chunks, maybe a few minutes today, a few tomorrow, and so forth. Now, Cuba has a long and complex history which cannot be summed up in one episode alone. Today I will be focusing on pre-revolutionary Cuba in the 20th century. This is by far the most consequential time in the country's history, both politically and socially. It saw the rise and fall of an American-backed capitalist democracy, soon to be replaced by the most successful communist government in world history, of course, in my opinion. This episode will then be followed up with an episode covering the revolution itself. So, let's think of this episode as a critical background story in order to better understand the revolution which forever changed the geopolitical face of the world. Anyways, we have around a half of a century of history to cover today, so let's dive in to this country known as Cuba. Now yes, I do want to focus in on the 20th century here, but of course, we need to set the stage. It is impossible to comprehend what happened in Cuba during the 20th century without going through some basic pre-20th century history first. Now, before the arrival of the Spanish explorers, Cuba was inhabited by two distinct groups of indigenous peoples, the Taíno, including the Siboney people, and the Guanahatabey. The Taíno arrived from Hispaniola sometime in the 3rd century AD. When Columbus arrived, they were the dominant culture in Cuba. It is unknown when or how the Guanahatabey arrived in Cuba, having both a different language and culture than the Taíno. It is often guessed that they were a relic population of pre-Taíno settlers in the northern Caribbean islands. Pre-Columbian Cuba was relatively stable and peaceful. Of course, that all changed on the 27th of October in 1492 when Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue and spotted Cuba. Columbus landed on the main island on the following day. Now, as per Columbus's ways, he subsequently claimed the entire island for the Kingdom of Spain, then a fledgling colonial empire well on its way to conquering the vast majority of Latin America. In 1511, the first European settlement was founded on the island, not far from modern-day Guantanamo in Baracoa. A few years later, Havana was founded, then known as San Cristobal de la Habana. In order to utilize this newly colonized land, the Spanish. See, this is what happens when I read a script. I mess up. Will I edit this out? Probably not. I may just forget I made that mistake. Anyways, the Spanish needed to make this venture a profitable one, okay? Now enter the first vestiges of capitalism in Cuba, encomienda. The encomienda was a popular Spanish system of labor which had many similarities to slavery. The laborers, in theory, were provided with benefits by the conquerors for whom they labored, the Catholic religion being the principal benefit. This system was already in place in Spain to force the Moorish population to convert to Catholicism. Within a century, the indigenous people were virtually wiped out due to multiple factors, primarily Eurasian infectious diseases, to which they had no natural immunity, of course, aggravated by harsh conditions of the repressive colonial subjugation. In 1529, a measles outbreak in Cuba killed two-thirds of those natives who previously survived the previous smallpox outbreaks. Cuba developed slowly, and unlike other plantation islands of the Caribbean, it had a diversified agriculture. Most importantly, the colony developed as an urbanized society that primarily supported the Spanish colonial empire. By the mid-18th century, there were around 50,000 slaves on the island, compared to 60,000 in Barbados, a much, much smaller island, and 300,000 in Virginia, as well as 450,000 in Saint-Domingue, modern-day Haiti, all of which had large-scale plantation economies. The largest factor for the growth of Cuba's commerce in the late 18th century and early 19th century was the Haitian Revolution. When the enslaved peoples of what then had been the Caribbean's richest colony freed themselves through violent revolution, Cuban planters perceived the region's changing circumstances with both a sense of fear and opportunity. They were afraid because of the prospect that slaves might revolt in Cuba, as well as numerous prohibitions during the 1790s on the sale of slaves in Cuba at the time that had previously been slaves in French colonies understood this anxiety. The planters saw opportunity, however, because they thought that they could exploit the situation by transforming Cuba into the slave society and sugar-producing so-called pearl of the Antilles that Haiti had once been before its revolution. As the historian Ada Ferrer has written, quote, at a basic level, liberation and Saint-Domingue helped entrench its denial in Cuba. As slavery and colonialism collapsed in the French colony, the Spanish island underwent a transformation that were almost the mirror image of Haiti's, end quote. Estimates suggest that between 1790 and 1820, some 320,000 slaves, likely much, much more due to the various undocumented slave ships that entered Cuba, were imported, which was actually four times more than the amount that had arrived between 1760 and 1790. Although a smaller proportion of the population of Cuba was enslaved at times, slaves arose in revolt. In 1812, the Aponte slave rebellion took place, but that was ultimately suppressed. In part due to Cuban slaves working primarily in urbanized settings, by the 19th century, the practice of coartation, I think that's how it's pronounced, has developed. Now, what that means is basically buying oneself out of slavery, which was a uniquely Cuban development, according to historian Herbert S. Klein. Due to a shortage of white labor, blacks dominated the urban industries to such an extent that when whites in large numbers came to Cuba in the middle of the 19th century, they were unable to displace the black workers. In the 1820s, when the rest of Spain's empire in Latin America rebelled and formed independent states, Cuba remained loyal to Spain. Its economy was based on serving the empire. By 1860, Cuba had 213,167 free people of color. That means that many free black people in Cuba, which is about 39% of Cuba's non-white population. By contrast, with the about the same number of blacks in Virginia, only about 11% were free. The rest were enslaved. So Cuba had a lot more free blacks than many other places that still had slavery in North America. This takes us to about 50 years before the time period which I want to focus on in today's episode. Up until the mid-19th century, Cuba had been relatively stable and very prosperous. This, however, all changed in 1868 when the first of several wars of independence were fought. I will not cover these conflicts in depth, but here is a heavily redacted overview. In 1868, a major sugar plantation owner, Carlos Manuel de Céspedes, freed his slaves on the condition that they would fight alongside him for an independent Cuba. Later in that year, he issued a decree condemning slavery and declaring that any slave who served in the rebellion to be free. Now, this rebellion was one part of a huge and, quite frankly, messy 10 years war, which quite, you know, literally was the first real global conflict. In the end, the rebellion was indeed successful, and Cuba declared independence in 1874. This, however, was fruitless. Although much of Latin America acknowledged Cuba's freedom from Spain, the United States did not. In essence, this is the first major instance of American political bullying in Cuba. In 1878, the short-lived independent nation relinquished Cuba's freedom back to Spain in exchange for greater autonomy. Now, this American bullying, well, get used to it, because it appears tons and tons and tons of more times in today's episode, and in fact, plays a crucial role as to Cuba's position today in Latin America and in the world on a greater sense. Now, the very next year, Cuban nationalist by the name of Galito Garcia attempted to start another war, but this was again very quickly quelled. Now, rewinding a bit back to the first war, this conflict actually brought about the official abolition of slavery in Cuba in 1875, but in reality, nobody took this law seriously. In fact, slavery in Cuba would last all the way until 1886. A third independence war took place early in 1895, in which the famed poet José Martí, remember him from the beginning, fought in and was killed. This too failed until, well, this is where I really want to start diving into as much detail as possible. So please, buckle up as we get into Cuba in the 20th century. Yes, a very long intro, but forgive me. Admittedly, the story does begin in 1898. Cuba, a colony seemingly always on the edge of full-fledged rebellion, Spain, a dying empire, and America, well, America being America, greedier than ever. It was shortly before 9:40 p.m. on a clear and dry February 15th, 1898. The USS Maine, a U.S. Navy vessel, lay quietly in Havana's harbor. Much of the crew were asleep. Suddenly, a massive explosion. The Maine found itself in flames, sinking to the bottom of the harbor, 252 crew killed in the blast. This explosion was much like any other ship explosion, a massively unfortunate accident. But something was different. Something was suspicious, so suspicious that it was the turning point in Cuba's history, the turning point in America's history, the turning point in Spain's history, and quite frankly, the turning point in many other countries' history. But today is not about them, it's about Cuba. It was directly responsible for so much that it is really hard to comprehend. And in fact, everything else spoken about in this episode is directly responsible or directly caused by the USS Maine exploding in 1898. See, this explosion was, and still is, to this day, as I'm recording this, mired in controversy. This cause of the accident was immediately debated among the United States military elite. Even the president at the time, William McKinley, was woken up in the ensuing panic in Washington. Although initially treated as an accident, it wasn't long until military officers pointed the finger at Spain. At this time, the United States was looking for any excuse to go to war with Spain, the last European power to have a major foothold in the Americas. This explosion was the perfect casus belli. The American bigwigs spent a considerable amount of time debating the cause of the explosion until a conclusion was reached. The US Navy's investigation, made public on March 28th of that year, concluded that the ship's powder magazines were ignited when an external explosion was set off under the ship's hull. This report poured fuel on popular indignation in the US, making war inevitable. Now, Spain's investigation came to the opposite conclusion. The explosion originated within the ship. Other investigations in years later came to various contradictory conclusions, but had no bearing on the coming of the war. Now, side note here, even in another investigation held in 1974 regarding this explosion, was unable to come to a concrete conclusion. The explosion could have occurred from an external source, like a ocean mine, or it could have just been as likely to be an unfortunate, tragic accident. Nonetheless, what could have been a simple misunderstanding turned into America's first major war of imperialism, the Spanish-American War. From this point on, Cuba's history would forever be tied to its neighbor, only 90-ish miles, my Canadian is showing, to the north. Although the Spanish-American War can really be seen as a global conflict with theaters in the Philippines, Guam, Cuba, and Puerto Rico, I will just be focusing in on Cuba, as per the theme of this episode. If you want a full Spanish-American War analysis, go find some war history podcast or something, I don't know. Anyways, it was no secret to many Cuban nationalists that the United States was the key to Cuba gaining its independence. Therefore, many Cubans were actually somewhat glad when the United States began its mission to declare war on Spain. However, Spain had other plans. Spain actually declared war on the United States first on April 24th of 1898, with the U.S. returning the favor the following day. Before long, in July of that year, Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders were charging San Juan Hill, which led to the siege on Santiago de Cuba. Less than 3 weeks later, the Spanish fleet in the Caribbean was obliterated off the coast of Santiago, forcing Spain to unofficially surrender. The war came to an end in the Caribbean on December 8th of 1898. But America seemingly felt very comfortable in Cuba. The U.S. occupied Cuba from 1898 until 1902 in what was the first of various American occupations. This first four-year occupation was an outright military occupation. There seemingly was no progress towards setting up a puppet state until the middle of 1901. During the first occupation, Cuba had three different military leaders. First was Adolfo Castellanos, who oversaw the surrender of Cuba. Then came John Rutter Brooke, who was actually an American general during the U.S. Civil War. He only served a few months in 1899 until being replaced by Leonard Wood. Now Wood, another military leader who would oversee Cuba until being replaced by Cuba's first democratically elected president, Tomas Estrada Palma. Now during these years, the Platt Amendment was passed. This amendment basically served as a figurative ball and chain for the Cuban government. In order for the U.S. to recognize Cuba as an independent colony, it had to do the following. First, never enter into an alliance with another country. Second, give the U.S. the right to intervene whenever it sees fit, among a few other slightly less notable things. But all of these things basically put a figurative ball and chain on Cuba and limited Cuba's freedom to act as an independent republic. Following the, forced acceptance of the amendment, the United States ratified a tariff that gave Cuban sugar a preference in the U.S. market and protection to select U.S. products in the Cuban market. The huge American investment in the sugar led to the land being concentrated in the hands of the largest sugar mills. However, with estimates that 20% of all Cuban land was owned by these mills. So 20% of Cuban land was owned by sugar mills, largely owned by American business. So in essence, the United States indirectly owned 20% of Cuban land. This led to further impoverishment of the rural masses. Workers on these mills were in constant fear of eviction, with cheap imported labor from other parts of the Caribbean keeping wages very low, and the prices for independent sugar came plummeting down due to these larger mills forcing them out of the market. In addition, the mills monopolized the railroads and ran them for private benefit. The lack of consumer purchasing power and the limited market availability for manufactured goods meant that little industrialization would occur in the decade after 1903 Treaty of Relations. Overall, over $200 million US dollars in that time's money, never mind today's money, was spent by American companies on Cuban sugar between 1903 and 1913. In essence, this is America's first real example of forcing a country into debt in order to solidify eternal servitude. China is doing the same thing today with many other Caribbean and African countries. Now, Tomas Estrada Palma, who had once favored outright annexation of Cuba by the United States, became president of Cuba on May 20th, 1902. He was then re-elected in 1905, despite of accusations of fraud from his liberal opponents, but he was forced to resign along with the rest of the executive when opposition against his rule turned violent. the United States invoked the Platt Amendment to begin the second occupation of Cuba and to install a provisional government. Now the U.S. just left Cuba, and now they're back in Cuba. Now the second occupation lasted from the fall of 1906 to late winter of 1909. Random fact, it was actually during this second occupation that Cuban baseball started to make a name for itself in the United States, with various Cuban professional players playing in the major leagues. I love baseball, if you couldn't tell. Anyways, this occupation was officially known as the Provisional Government of Cuba, but it was nothing more than an American military occupation. When the government of Cuban President Tomas Estrada de Palma collapsed, the U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt ordered a U.S. military intervention into Cuba. Their mission was to prevent fighting between the Cubans to protect U.S. economic interests and to hold free, very heavy quotes on free, elections in order to establish a new and, again, heavy quotes on legitimate government. Following the election of José Miguel Gómez in November 1908, the U.S. officially judged Cuba to be officially, sufficiently, and sustainably stable for the U.S. to withdraw its troops, and process that was completed in February of 1909. Now I'm going to divert very, very briefly here. During the early decades of the 20th century, the United States really began to flex its military muscle around Latin America. This is what later became known as the Banana Wars. Basically, these were a series of conflicts in the following countries. First, Cuba, of course, Puerto Rico, not really a country, but in this case, we'll call it a country, Honduras, Nicaragua, which saw the most conflict of all, Mexico, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. These wars were fledgling conflicts which made the United States a true imperialist nation. Anyways, back to Cuba. What is largely seen as the part of the Greater Banana Wars occurred in 1912, a few years after the second occupation. This was known as the, bear with me as I practice my Spanish, Levantamiento Armado de los Independientes de Color. I did okay there. Or in English, the Armed Uprising of the Independents of Color, or simply put by the Americans, the Negro Rebellion. This, well, it's pretty self-explanatory, but it plays a key role in setting the stage for later events in Cuba, which would eventually lead to the revolution. Now, before I get into details here, I will give a quick disclaimer. Some of the events described in the following part of the episode are a bit dramatic and a bit graphic, so if you are queasy, well, I'm sorry, you have to learn. This is history, it's very important. Anyways, for lack of better terms, this uprising was a race war, even though it was a race war on a small scale. Conditions in Cuba were poor for the black inhabitants, most of whom were employed in the sugarcane industry. Evaristo Atenos led a movement to better these conditions, which had begun in 1895 during the War for Independence from Spain. Now, veterans of that war, primarily officers, organized the Independent Party of Color in 1908. Now, under the leadership of Atenos, the party quickly gained support from many Afro-Cubans in opposition to the Cuban president, José Miguel Gómez. Now, Gómez ordered the party disbanded under the Morrua Law, which outlawed political parties based on race. Now, of course, this law was obviously targeted towards black Cubans. By 1912, the government sent a detachment of 688 U.S. Marines, officers, and enlisted men to the Guantanamo naval base while Atenos and his followers were preparing a rebellion. Though they were lightly armed, the rebels numbered several hundred men, mainly campesinos, or in English, peasants. Now, fueled by reports of Afro-Cuban rapes of wealthy white women, inspired various white militias to form all over Cuba. On May 26th, the newspaper El Día put into words which the many wealthy white Cubans fed on. Now here's a quote from that day's paper. Quote, "This is a racist uprising, an uprising of blacks. In other words, an enormous danger. Such uprisings are moved by hatred and their purpose is negative, perverse. They only conceived by something as black as hatred. They do not try to win, but to hurt, to destroy, to harm, and they do not have any purpose, and they follow the natural bent of all armed people without aim and driven by atavistic, brutal instincts and passions. They devote themselves to robbery, pillage, murder, and rape. There are in all parts and latitudes of the world characteristics of race struggles. Racial uprisings are naturally cursed. They are the cry, the voice of barbarism, and everywhere the voice of guns, which is the voice of civilization, answers and has to answer them. And this is the kind of movement of activity that one can see in all the Cuban country. Civilization is arming itself against barbarism and getting ready to defend itself against barbarism. This is the free and beautiful America defending herself against the clawing scratch of Africa. End quote. Take that in. Newspaper published on May 26th, El Día. Blatantly racist. I can go into that article much longer, but I won't. Anyways, other publications carried on this racist tone even further, exploiting deeply rooted racist ideas from the Spanish Empire and brushing up on newly acquired racist rhetoric largely from the United States. Exaggerated and straight-up false reports of black attacks on whites were everywhere. Another sad and interesting aspect of public reaction is that this newspaper reports and government rhetoric assumed and implied that skin color alone determined your side in the conflict. It was known fact that many Afro-Cubans did not agree with the Partido Independiente de Color, nor were they members of the party or participants in the demonstrations. All over the island, Afro-Cubans were arrested, harassed, and killed simply out of suspicion. Suddenly, on May and June of 1912, it was very dangerous to be black in Cuba. Men and women were attacked by militias as they were walking home from work or visiting with friends. There was a great deal of suspicion that all Afro-Cubans were secretly involved in this so-called race war. The massacre continued into June. In Boquerón, near Guantanamo Bay, a captain and five volunteers beheaded a policeman and stabbed to death five others who had been arrested on an unsubstantiated charge of conspiring with Jamaicans to aid the rebels. On June 10th, the U.S. consul filed a report stating that, quote, many innocent and defenseless Negroes in the region are being butchered, end quote. Now, this is pretty damn ironic because the same thing was occurring in the United States at the time, and occurring under legal protection, especially in the South, with the rash of lynchings that happened in the early 20th century. Bodies of suspected rebels were left hanging outside of towns for so-called moral reasons, and severed heads were placed on the side of railroad tracks so that the train passengers could see them. Several Afro-Cuban veteran officers were arrested in early June, even though they were neither members of the party, nor did they support the rebels. Their only crime was to question the wisdom of racist violence and the concept of a race war being nurtured. They were later released for, of course, lack of evidence. Other Afro-Cuban veterans of the War of Independence, such as Jesus Rabi and Florencio Salcedo, also protested the fact that all troops sent to Oriente were under the rule of white officers. Now, Oriente was and still is the blackest region in Cuba. That's where most of Afro-Cuban people live. In the cities, theories of black conspiracies were everywhere. One popular theory involved a plot by Haitians and Jamaicans to take over the country. Another involved conservatives seeking U.S. annexation. None had any basis in reality, but added immensely to the fear and confusion of the time. In order to put a quick end to the situation and avoid another U.S. military intervention, President Gomez allowed the reinstitution of concentration camps in Oriente province. Families were forced into these camps by the thousands, clearing out the countryside, so that anyone found roaming about was deemed an enemy combatant and killed. On May 31st, the independents attempted to show the determination with a, quote, limited sabotage, unquote. In Oriente, they burned a bridge, a post office, and the barracks of a rural guard, some wooden houses that belonged to the Santa Cecilia Sugar Company, and a railway station. On June 1st, they took control of the town of La Maija, where Afro-Cubans were the majority, and burned down some houses. There were no casualties or injuries in this attack. and Santa Clara Independence formed two fugitive bands with a total of about 50 men. The government sent 3,000 well-armed soldiers and volunteers to deal with them. 50 fugitives armed with out-of-date weapons, many of them pitchforks, knives, machetes, against 3,000 well-armed, armed by America, soldiers and volunteers. People volunteered to attend what would be an obvious massacre of innocents fighting for equal racial rights. Quote, the movement was crushed immediately, everywhere except in Oriente, especially Guantanamo region, end quote. Now, Hugh Thomas wrote this in Cuba. He was a famous historian at the time and author. He continued with, quote, the alarm was nevertheless immense. Havana being overwhelmed by panic, everyone had feared a Negro uprising for years. The atmosphere resembled the great fear in the French Revolution, end quote. The methods of elimination were as brutal and barbaric as ever seen on the island. Decapitated bodies were left on the roadside, rotting, full of maggots. And Afro-Cubans who tried to turn themselves into the authorities were killed for allegedly trying to escape. They turned themselves in and were killed for, well, allegedly trying to escape. Luis Perez explained with this quote here. It's a long one, so bear with me. Quote, what occurred in eastern Cuba in 1912 was only marginally related to the armed movement organized by the Partido Independiente de Color. The Independiente protest set in motion a larger protest. The political spark ignited the social conflagration, and the countryside was set ablaze. Disorder quickly assumed the proportions of a peasant jacquerie. An outburst of rage and the release of a powerful destructive fury directed generally at the sources and symbols of oppression. As is often the case with peasant movements, the uprising processed a formless and desultory character. It was a popular outburst born of social distress and directed not at government but at local social groups and specific conditions of abuse. It was without a program of reform, without commitment to a unifying program, without organization, without defined policy, and without formal leadership. The protests gave expression to collective rage, and for all the spontaneity and ambiguity, it was not without method and meaning. As an outcry against injustice, it sought at once to destroy the dispossessors and expel the expropriators in one surge of violence and destruction. The protesters attacked property, they plundered and pillaged mostly foreign property and mostly sugar property, and together these activities served to define the essential character of the uprising. The yearning for an old way served as a source of destruction of the new ones. These were veterans of war, of liberation. These people had once served before in a war with fire. Arson was a weapon of rural protest, long familiar to the farmers and peasants of Oriente. End quote. A lot of that can actually be drawn with similarities to recent protests in the United States regarding racial injustice, but I will go into that later on in the episode. Now, about 10,000 Afro-Cubans participated in this uprising, which was never involved confronting individuals. Not once did protesters engage civilians or government troops in combat. It's impossible to tell exactly how many Afro-Cubans died. Now, official Cuban sources at the time put the number of dead rebels at more than 2,000. Now, these 2,000 consisted of U.S. citizens living in Oriente. Estimated that 5,000 to 6,000 black people died Now, it's impossible to tell exactly how many Afro-Cubans died. Official Cuban sources put the number of dead rebels at more than 2,000 U.S. citizens. It's impossible to tell exactly how many Afro-Cubans died. Official Cuban sources put the number of dead rebels at more than 2,000. Now, U.S. citizens living in Oriente estimated that around 5,000 to 6,000 died. In contrast, the official figure for the total dead armed forces was 16, including 8 Afro-Cubans murdered by their white compatriots and some men shot by friendly fire. The few militiamen charged with any crimes were pardoned, and most of the atrocities were not investigated. The various volunteer militia roaming the Oriente countryside looking to engage independence added to their share of damage, appropriating properties, horses, livestock, and causing their share of property damage. Evaristo Estenos, one of the leaders of the party, was shot at point-blank range, killed on June 27th. Pedro Ivonet gave himself up on July 18th, but was killed the same day again, allegedly trying to escape. It was alleged that a secret agreement had existed between President Gomez, Ivonet, and Estenos, in which the president would intervene to end the demonstrations and the Morua law would be abolished. The party would not throw its support behind a second term for the presidency, even though they were alleged to. If such an agreement existed, it has never been proved. The papers and personal effects of Ivonet and Estenos were never recovered. Whatever myth existed about racial equality in Cuba shattered in May and June of 1912. Not only was there no significant cry of outrage about the massacre from white Cubans, but the majority of newspaper accounts and editorials expressed a kind of racism not seen in Cuba since immediately after the abolition of slavery in 1886. Editorials pointed out that Cuba, one of two opposed races, forcibly had to succumb or to submit, to pretend that both live together united by bonds and brotherly love and sentiment is to aspire to the impossible. Others recommended that Cuba be, quote, ruled by the small white elite through a system of plural vote that overrepresented the upper class, and the blacks' access to politics and public jobs be limited due to their lesser preparation. And yet others suggested looking to the US for a blueprint on race relations. This draws a lot of similarities to apartheid South Africa and modern-day Israel. This period of severe violent racist attacks was not only, well, racist, but it fed into the ever-growing distrust of Cuba's ruling elite. To just sit back and let the massacre of Afro-Cubans, many of them poor, demonstrated a sort of dangerous apathy to Cuba's socio-economic troubles. This, one can argue, was the fertilization of the soil which the seeds of the revolution would soon be planted. And that brings me to the end of part one of today's episode. Yes, we're only partway through the entire episode. But it's always good to take a little break. Cuba's history is, well, sometimes hard to digest and, quite frankly, straight up impossible to understand fully. Enjoy a few seconds of calming music and get ready to dive into more, well, okay, well, I don't know how to describe it. You'll just have to continue listening. Guajira para el recuerdo. Okay, I hope you're all relaxed. Have a coffee or a tea in hand, or maybe some rum. Let's dive into the remainder of today's episode. There is no doubt in any historian's mind that 1912 was an especially hard year for Cuba. But unfortunately, the hard times were to continue. Our story of struggle continues in the spring of 1913 with the election of Cuba's first conservative president, Mario García Menosal. Menosal managed to secure around 195,000 votes compared to his opponent's 180,000. Now keep in mind, Cuba at this time had a population of well over 2 million. So what happened to the at least 1 million other adults who should be able to vote? Well, during this time, democracy in Cuba was, well, not so democratic. See, Cuba's voting system heavily favored the rich white elite. White male elite. Meanwhile, the majority of Cuba was not rich, not white, and therefore not elite. Therefore, the numbers of voters always was very, very low compared to the overall population. Okay, back to Menosal. Menosal's first term was very uneventful. In fact, this term, Cuba did participate in World War I with the Allies, but their impact was minimal. He was also a huge supporter of big business in Cuba, especially American business. This support for large corporations would lead to some trouble during his second term. See, Menosal was re-elected in 1916, and at this time, by a much slimmer margin. This close election created a sense of distrust from the long losing opposition. Sound familiar? Well, the liberals who lost the election, led by a former president, José Miguel Gómez, aided by a few other less notable figures, including a professional baseball player at that, led an insurgency against the current Manosal government. These insurgents, deemed as radical leftists, again, sound familiar, were mostly concentrated on the eastern half of the island, again, in Oriente, where all the poorer black people lived. This was no coincidence. Eastern Cuba was much blacker and much poorer than Western Cuba. Eastern Cuba was also home to many of Cuba's wealthy plantations. Once the plantation owners caught wind of the pending rebellion, they sought protection from the United States. Very soon after, on February 12th, the United States shipped soldiers to Cuba once again, starting their sugar intervention. This, among other small events, managed to quell the immediate threat, well, for the time being. However, this changed in early July of 1917. That was when Manosal and his government suspended the Constitution. This basically meant that anyone could be arrested for no reason and for no set period of time. This was justified with the claim of stopping German spies from operating in Cuba. The world was at war, after all. However, it was truly done to quell the dissent of the liberals and those who fed up with the large plantation owners. It wasn't long before Manosal agreed to the United States sending just under 1,000 U.S. Marines to the island. Now, technically speaking, this was not an invasion. Rather, the Cuban government invited the U.S. troops. Therefore, the Marines had to stay within strict limits imposed by the Cuban government. The Marines' main purpose during the first year of the occupation was to protect the sugar plantations. After all, these plantations were largely backed by U.S. companies and provided the U.S. with a cheap source of sugar. But it wasn't long until the working class and emerging middle class started to protest the U.S. occupation. In December of 1917, another 1,000 Marines arrived. During 1918, the occupation started to look more, well, like an occupation. U.S. troops patrolled the countryside and gathered intelligence on the working and middle classes of Cuba. By the middle of the year, the countryside was, well, for lack of better terms, pacified, and the main trouble was coming from the larger cities. These protests in the cities quickly spread throughout the entire country. Throughout 1918 into 1919, of course, these protests were deemed as leftist by the United States, thus driving them to send an additional 1,000 plus troops to the island. Very soon, an additional 6,000 U.S. troops were sent to Cuba. This additional military presence was, of course, to ensure no major leftist revolution took place on the island. It wasn't until 1922 when the U.S. troops left much of the island, only keeping their foothold in Guantanamo Bay. Although the sugar intervention was the final so-called battle of the banana wars in Cuba, it was just a part of the prelude to widespread revolution. This occupation not only worsened the Cuban working class relationship with the United States, but it started to sow distrust among the Cuban middle class towards the United States. However, the government did nothing to deal with this fact. In fact, they went along the path of creating closer relations to the United States. In 1924, Gerardo Machado was elected president of Cuba. His rule was marked by one thing: tourism. Under Machado, Cuba became the playground for the United States mafias. Gambling and prostitution was rampant, and would remain so for decades to come. This would lead to Machado's decline in popularity. Although losing support, Machado did win another term in office, despite promising just to serve one term. And this, well, this brings us to 1933. And while things from here on move very fast and crazy, so strap in, people, it goes fast from here. 1933 was the year in which the notorious Fulgencio Batista rose to fame. The year where general strikes, organized socialism, nationalism, and military rebellion would take place. In all honesty, Cuba in 1933 would take hours to dissect. But neither of us have hours to spend, so I will try my best to be as brief and detailed as possible. Now, Machado's second term was much more authoritarian than the first. Free speech was basically eliminated. That, on top of the economic fallout of the Great Depression, combined with large-scale workers and student protest, forced Machado to resign in August of 1933. Now, Machado was replaced by Carlos Manuel Céspedes y Quesada. Now, Machado's replacement was not a popular choice among Machado's opponents. In fact, Cespedes was seen as just another American puppet and promoter of American interventionism. Just a few weeks later, the same student union which had Machado deposed was working towards deposing Cespedes. The Cuban military was also observing the situation as very precarious. Supporters of Machado were often attacked by Machado's opposition. Even soldiers and police fell victim to these attacks. At first, the military was hesitant on stepping in, but that neutrality soon ended. The military quickly fell into line with the very local and vocal critics of Cespedes. This tense situation caused the reemergence of issues which plagued Cuba regarding race, class, and age-related tensions. This was especially pronounced amongst the military officers. At the same time, the working class populations of Cuba were fed up with the conditions of their labor. On July 27th, Havana bus drivers went on strike for their own demands, and 2 days later, intercity truck drivers rose up in solidarity. Soldiers fired on demonstrators in Havana on August 1st, killing two on the same day in Santa Clara, shops and theaters were closed. When police attacked a group of striking teachers, more transportation workers went on strike. In Pinar del Ríos, drivers, tobacco workers, and journalists also went on strike. In the meantime, the Sugar Workers Union organized demonstrations and hunger marches throughout the entire country. In the following days, more groups joined the campaign. In Havana, many storekeepers closed and garages refused to sell gas. Typographers and journalists struck, and the longshoremen dockers walked out. The Cuban Communist Party was not only supporting the workers' demands, but also called for an end to the Machado regime. There were reports of many strikes in the interior of the country, and a central strike committee was organized. The Cuban Confederation of Labor called for a general strike and to begin on August 5th. The regime responded by arresting more than 100 labor leaders and other campaign supporters and tried to round up the telegraph operators to force them to go to work. Police fired on a crowd, killing 20 and wounding over 100, including women and children. Leaders of the campaign broadcast appeals to those people to stay off the streets to reduce the chance of escalating repressive violence. By August 6th, more groups joined the strike. Railway workers, hotel and restaurant workers, physicians, bakers, cigar makers, among countless others. The campaign escalated when government employees went on strike in the sanitation, communications, and treasury department of the government. Electric and telephone utilities even locked their employees inside to prevent them from striking. This unrest amongst the working people of Cuba poured more fuel on the fire which was Machado's rule, and even more fire on the unsatisfactory rule on Cespedes, and this general strike was the first true act of communist rebellion in Cuba. On September 3rd and 4th, some lower-ranking officers led by the charismatic and young Fulgencio Batista at Columbia Barracks directly raised issues of back pay and promotions to the senior officers. On September 4th, Captain Mario Torres Menier appeared at a meeting of the enlisted men at Camp Columbia. Batista allowed him to enter. The soldiers made their complaints with the mounting enthusiasm. Torres Menier withdrew to consult the other superior officers with another scheduled meeting to occur for 8 p.m. The meeting that evening took place in a theater. The senior officers had been excluded. Batista spoke from on stage, declaring, quote, "From this moment forward, do not obey anyone's orders but mine. First, sergeants must immediately take control of their respective military units. If there is no first sergeant, or if he refuses to take command, the senior sergeant must do so. If there is no sergeant, a corporal. If there is no willing corporal, then a soldier. And if not, then a recruit. The units must have someone in command, and he must be an enlisted man." End quote. And with those words, the lower-ranking military officials, mainly the sergeants, took control of the barracks and soon spread the coup to other cities. Many of the student union people and members also came to the barracks to join forces with the military. This occurred while Cespedes was away from Havana dealing with some hurricane damage. While he was away, the rebels forced Cuba's government officials to leave their posts in Havana. They then announced that they were in control of the country. Céspedes was then forced to leave his office on September 5th of 1933. And on that day, September 5th of 1933, Cuba's history will, well, reoccurring theme here, forever be changed. The military junta of officers and students proclaimed that it had taken power in order to fulfill the aims of the revolution. It briefly described a program which included economic restructuring, punishment of wrongdoers, recognition of public debts, and creation of courts, political reorganization, and any other actions necessary to construct a new Cuba based on justice and democracy. Only 5 days after the coup, Batista and the student union promoted Ramón Grau to the role of president, thus ending the military rule. Grau, however, would not last long in his new role. His government was made famous for being the infamous 100-day government. It only lasted from September 5th of 1933 to January 15th of 1934. I told you, things move really fast from here. At first, Grau was viewed as a decent leader, although he was basically Batista's puppet. See, Batista was put in charge of the military, and he who controls the military always controls the country. Other than that, Grau implemented policies which went against the current Cuban oligarchy and made it harder for U.S. companies to do business in Cuba. Batista very, very much was against this. Various measures were taken, such as the establishment of the Secretariat as a Ministry of Labor, the establishment of minimum wage, the 8-hour workday, the confiscation of property of Gerardo Machado and his collaborators, the cleanup of state institutions, the nationalization of labor, and ensuring that half of jobs were carried out by those born in Cuba, price cuts for everyday necessities, and reductions in electrical rates. These measures were not fully implemented because of the brief duration of the government. Reformists were accepted by the administration for the first time in Cuba, which made it possible for the government to carry out his struggle for the general welfare of Cuban society more directly than ever before. Nevertheless, internal disagreements in the government and the lack of experience on the part of labor movement leaders and the masses in their struggle to achieve their objectives hindered the effectiveness in achieving it. Grau's 100-day government lasted until January 15th of 1934, when Grau was forced to resign by, of course, Batista, who had been conspiring with Summer Welles of the American State Department. Grau was replaced by Carlo Hevia, and within 5 days, the U.S. recognized Cuba's new government. Now, Grau was, in my opinion, the first true leader of the Cuban people. He put the interests of the people before those of the elite, and he was punished for it. This was, of course, an unpopular move with the Cuban working class. The decades following the 1930s would see the distrust and unsatisfaction amongst the working class snowball, and snowball quickly at that. Anyways, Grau's replacement lasted 3 days. Yes, just 3 days. Hevia was very unpopular with the military and, so-called voluntarily, handed his resignation to Batista. He was then replaced by Manuel Marquez Sterling, who served, get this, less than 5 hours. Crazy stuff. He was then replaced by Carlo Mendieta later that day. Keep in mind, Cuba was a so-called democracy, and at the time, just a period of few months, with 4 different presidents and no elections being held. Of course, the true power lay with Batista. Mendieta served around just 2 years, and in that time he signed a new trade agreement with the United States, raised minimum wage to $30 per month, and arrested various union leaders, and basically ignored all workers' rights violations that occurred on the sugar plantations. He did, however, allow women the right to vote, although no meaningful election took place for a while and wouldn't take place for a while to come. Mendieta was replaced on December 11th of 1935 by José Barnet, who lasted 6 months, and finally, an election. Miguel Mariano Gómez, the 8th leader since Machado, and the first elected leader since, lasted for a grand total of 7 months. He was impeached on Christmas Eve of 1936 for vetoing a law which sent some sugar revenue to rural schools. This was likely a plot of Batista to overthrow this democratically elected leader. Gomez was then replaced by Frederico Laredo Bru. He actually made it a full term, nearly 4 years as president. Bru continued the advance of workers' rights in Cuba, adding pensions and insurance to the rights of workers. He also moved towards installing Cubans as the leaders of Cuban businesses rather than Americans. Under Brew, Cuban communists began their steady rise to power in the newly formed unions supported by the Cuban government. Brew and Batista worked closely together in creating an overall higher standard of living for the working class Cubans. At the end of Brew's term as president, Batista, supported by socialists and communists, defeated a disgruntled Ramon Grau, remember him from the 100-day rule, and became Cuba's first and only non-white president. That's where I will end today's historical storytelling. Batista's rule would be best covered in an episode dedicated to the revolution itself. Plus, I do want to spend some time in this episode sort of providing a bit more social context to the events which transpired in Cuba between the end of the 19th century and entering the 1940s. Cuba, up until this point, was a largely production-based country. Its main raw materials were sugar, tobacco, amongst other smaller exports. This plantation economy created a wealth gap which was much, much larger than the consumer countries like that of the United States and Spain. As is the same with most somewhat poorer countries, a wealth gap is much more than just a wealth gap. Wealth creates a very obvious social divide. Those who have money always separate themselves from those who do not. This wealth gap affected all populations, whether European, African, or somewhere in between. Wealth in Cuba played an omnipresent role in forging the island's history. The second defining factor in Cuban society at the time was race and nationality. According to the 1931 Cuban census, Cuba had more of a diverse population than many other Latin American countries. Roughly 11% of its population was foreign-born, many of them from Spain and Haiti. Furthermore, more than 25% of Cuba had African ancestry, whether pure African or mixed European and African heritage. Amongst this mestizo population, we find Fulgencio Batista. The third determining factor in Cuban society was where these people lived. Cuba's largest city at the time was, of course, Havana. But most Cubans at the time lived in Oriente, the province where we find Guantanamo, Santiago de Cuba, and Las Tunas, all places which will make an appearance in the episode where I discuss the revolution itself. See, Oriente is important to understand in the context of revolution because it was where most mixed and Afro-Cubans lived. It was where the most sugar was produced, and it was where Cuba's poorest citizens lived. Much of the radical revolutionary activity began in this region amongst its poorest citizens. While researching and writing the script for today's episode, I could not help but point out the obvious factors leading to revolution, and how those things are happening in today's world. Cuba, a country with a huge racial divide, is largely reminiscent of Canada and the United States and the racial injustice that occurs here. The poor working class of Cubans in the earlier 20th century make me think of today's working class and the rising unemployment thanks to Chinese capitalist imperialist companies. This, of course, is happening all over the Caribbean. I've seen many, many examples in Jamaica, Trinidad, Barbados, Guyana, as well as the remainder of many African countries. The sucking up to American business interests makes me think of those countries which still allow the United States and China to take advantage of the poorer quality of life. If you ever visit a country like Jamaica, you would very quickly notice huge Chinese factories in Uganda, in Kenya, in Tanzania. All over Africa, you would notice huge Chinese and American factories taking advantage of these people, forcing the countries into debt, and forcing the country to send its citizens to work for foreign companies. In many ways, Cuba of the earlier 20th century is an early version of the world we are experiencing today. In fact, the world really hasn't changed at all much since this time. The only big thing that has changed in today's context, well, is how Cuba dealt with the situation. How an island of people tossed around by the United States took a stand and stuck it to old Uncle Sam. They were heroes, and that is very hard to argue against. Those like Fidel Castro, Camilo Cienfuegos, and Che Guevara paved the way for other revolutionaries across Latin America and the world. Unfortunately, those revolutions led by the people did not have the firepower to stand up against the bastion that is American capitalism. Now, in the next episode, I will go into this in more details, but I will share this briefly. Cuba today is among the world's leaders in healthcare, education, and standard of life. Cuba has eliminated homelessness and is among the world's leaders in doctors being sent overseas to aid in crises. Communist Cuba, you can say, sounds good and does work. To those who look down on heroes like Castro and his fellow revolutionaries, I encourage you to listen to my next episode. In that episode, I will discuss the revolution in detail, starting with Batista in 1940, right until the communist heroes of the revolution declared victory for the people of Cuba. Anyways, thank you for listening today. The episode could have been longer, but I'm sure you are all tired of me talking and are grateful for this episode coming to an end. I appreciate your support for the podcast, and I am forever grateful. This podcast has grown a lot in the past year. Not like in the thousands, but in the hundreds. And I'm extremely grateful, and I did not expect this much support for my show. As usual, follow me on social media. You'll find the links in the description of this episode. I'm Nate. This is the Left the Leftist podcast, and you'll hear from me soon. Hopefully, I will not guarantee a time, because it will take me a while to get ready. When I discuss the purpose of this entire episode. So basically, if you've reached this point, you have to listen to my next episode. If you don't, you're only getting half the story, and you will only understand half of the history of the island of Cuba. Anyways, thanks for listening.